Well, we turn this morning to the book of Isaiah once again. And this morning we come to the chapter 46. We're looking at these closing chapters from chapter 40 onwards in Isaiah. And these chapters constitute what is called the Book of Consolation. And they are dealing with great themes, the purpose of which is to comfort God's people. Comfort ye my people, says your God. And we're looking at these chapters, not in their entirety, but we're taking themes and thoughts out of the chapters as we come through them. Sometimes taking maybe a verse, we're going to look at single verses, and we're going to be looking at times at a whole chapter in order to isolate something of importance for us. We have to keep in mind that these chapters are dealing with history. They're also dealing with prophecy. And they are dealing with events that have to do with Isaiah's own day and in the near future from Isaiah's own day. But they also deal with events in the far future. They deal with events that are taking place in the world today, in the times of Messiah's gospel, going to the ends of the earth and all the nations coming to recognize that the God of Israel is the God of salvation. And these chapters also extend into the new heaven and the new earth that we read about in the end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, and in other places also. These chapters are the ones that the New Testament refers to more than to any other of the chapters in Isaiah. And we find that the New Testament writers found that what Isaiah was speaking about applied very clearly without any sense of contradiction or obscurity. Isaiah's prophecies in these chapters dealt with the Christian doctrines of salvation, the Christian hope and the Christian times. So we're looking at these chapters, not through the eyes of Judaism, but through the eyes of Christianity. And we read the Bible not as those who simply have the Old Testament, but we have the New Testament, which sheds light on the Old Testament scriptures. In order to understand the Old Testament properly, we need the New Testament's interpretation. And in order to understand the New Testament properly, we need the Old Testament's foundation. You can't understand the New Testament without knowing at least something of the general outline of Old Testament teaching. And likewise, when we come to read the Old Testament, we read it in the light of the New Testament's finality and fulfillment. Well, we've been looking over the past number of weeks now at various themes in these chapters. Last time, you remember, we were looking in chapter 45 and at the opening verses there, where the Lord was speaking concerning Cyrus, the king of Persia, that young, mighty warrior who captured Babylon and who established the Persian Empire. Indeed, he's called Cyrus the Great. And the Lord calls him his shepherd at the end of chapter 47, you remember? 44, rather, verse 28. And at the beginning of chapter 45 that we're looking at last time, he's called the Lord's Christ, his Messiah. And Cyrus didn't know the Lord. There's no evidence, as far as we know, from any references to him that he ever was a convert to the God of Israel. But the Lord knew him, and the Lord raised him up for a specific purpose. And one of the applications of this, as we saw last time, there are quite a number of applications, of course, but one of the applications was that every human life has its part to play in God's great plan of salvation. Many people who never know the Lord nonetheless have contributed in some way or other to the fulfillment of God's purposes of grace. Now we come to this chapter 46 this morning. And one of the things that we find scattered throughout these chapters in Isaiah, and we're going to focus on this morning, is the fact that God is purposeful. I can hardly think of any other way to put it. I suppose we could summarize it and say God's purpose and God's sovereignty and all of that's true. We're going to comment on that in a moment. But the idea of God having a plan and a purpose is something that we find scattered throughout the Bible, of course, but also scattered throughout these chapters and referred to implicitly and explicitly right throughout these closing chapters. I've already indicated, you remember, on a previous occasion how when we read through these chapters in Isaiah, we find that the same themes are coming up again and again. And it's almost as though the Lord is afraid that we miss it the first time, so he's going to tell us it again. And even when he tells it again, it's almost as though he's afraid that we're going to forget it. And so he reminds us again. It's like the Lord's Supper. Do this in remembrance of me. And how can it be that God's people would ever forget Christ and what he has done for us on the cross? But the fact is we do. Or we forget the import of it. And we live almost as if it never happened at times. And so we are forced to remember. And we are encouraged to remember. As Paul instructs the Ephesians, you remember, in second chapter in Ephesians. Wherefore remember, he says to them, what it was like before you were converted. Wherefore remember that at that time you were strangers, you were foreigners, you were aliens to God. You didn't belong in those days. But now you have been brought near by the blood of Christ. Now it's this same kind of theme of remembrance, insisting that we never forget. In the same way as Paul reminds the Corinthians in chapter 15 of the resurrection, I remind you again, he says, how Christ died for our sins and was buried and rose again on the third day according to the scriptures, that you keep this in mind. This is the important thing always to remember. So here we have the Lord reminding us again in this chapter that he is a God who works according to a purpose. And the verses I want to draw our attention to particularly this morning are these verses 9 to 11 in Isaiah chapter 46, verses 9 to 11. Remember, the Lord says, remember. In other words, he's drawing our attention to things that we are already familiar with. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, there is none else. I am God and there is none like me. He is saying, remember this, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure, calling the ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. Yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it. And I also will do it. And so here we are being reminded again that God is going to do something. As he fulfilled his purpose in the past, so in the present he is fulfilling his purposes. And he is saying, I have purposed it and I will bring it to pass. And there are a number of places in the scriptures where we're reminded it's not just that God does it, but that he is going to do it zealously. The zeal of the Lord will perform this. In other words, God is keen to accomplish and to bring to pass what he has planned to do for his people. And this is the great theme that we have in these verses and that I want us to think about this morning. And I want to think about this because there's a danger, you see, that when we think about God, we might think about God in very limited terms. We may think of God in terms of our own experience of God, our own limited little time on the earth, 70 years or 80 years or 100 years, whatever our lifespan is, it's a brief and uncertain period. And we may only view God from the things that we have learned. Sometimes we hear people saying that they have learned by experience. And there is no question whatsoever that we do learn by experience. But the fact of the matter is, we don't learn very much by experience, for the simple reason that our experiences are not amounting to very much. Our experiences are limited. Supposing you and I had traveled the world, supposing we had tasted every delicacy and every delight, supposing we had read all the important books, that thousand important books that the literati tell us we must read before we die. I'm sure you've seen the adverts. Here are 1,000 books you must read before you die. Well, supposing we did read the 1,000 books before we die, what would we have learned? When you think of it, really, we would have learned a great deal and at the same time have learned a great little, because it's so limited. Everything about us is characterized by finitude and by folly and by fallenness. And so when we think of God, the danger is that we will limit God to our experiences of God, or to what we think God is going to do or what He should be doing. But here in the Scriptures and in these chapters in Isaiah, we're being reminded that God has an overarching purpose. The danger, you see, for the people of Israel in the days of Isaiah was that they would think that God was interested in them, only in them. Now, there's no question that God is interested in His people particularly, but it is quite wrong to think that God is interested in His people only. He reminds them He is the God of all the earth. He has already told us in the end of chapter 45, you remember, at verse 22, "Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the ends of the earth, for I am God and there is none else." And He has a purpose that at the end every knee shall bow to Him. Verse number 23, you remember, "I have sworn by myself, the word is gone out of my mouth in righteousness and shall not return." In other words, it won't return unfulfilled, empty and vain. "And every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall swear that God is the Lord alone." So here we have a reminder, a little hint again and again, of the big picture of how God views and how God controls His world. And we've got to see, in the midst of the conflicts and the confusions of our own times and the confusions of our own lives, because we're all a bundle of contradictions. If you read the Puritans, for example, you will find that many of them, they were good physicians of the soul. They have been described as physicians of the soul, these Puritans, because they were so analytical. And they would go into 20 points and 20 further sub-points, subdividing the issues of Christian experience and doctrine. And at times one becomes almost wearied with them and one loses track of where they're going. But when you really take time and analyze, you'll find that they were really digging up pure gold for God's people and trying to write down the great mysteries of providence, as they would call it. And what they were trying to do was to explain to God's people that the ways of God are beyond our finding out, and that God is doing things that we simply don't know what He was doing. And we may well be mistaken at times in reading the signs of the times in which we live. The people of God in Isaiah's day, they were becoming demoralized because the powers, Assyria was on the rise. And Assyria in a few short years was going to take away the whole of the northern 10 tribes. And in the future, 200 years hence from the time that the prophet is living and prophesying, he is reminding them that the Babylonians are going to come and they're going to take away the people of God to Babylon and they're going to put them into the exile. And then they're going to be returned again through Cyrus. So here God's people in the immediate are being rather pessimistic and discouraged. You remember how Hezekiah, when the prophet Isaiah, and Hezekiah is one of the kings, you remember, during whose reign Isaiah was ministering. He was ministering to four kings, and through the reigns of four kings in Judah. And Hezekiah, the good man that he was indeed one of those kings. And you remember how there was an extension of 15 years added to his life. And you remember how the prophet Isaiah assured him that all was going to be well in his reign. And you remember the last thing we're told in Isaiah about good King Hezekiah. He was content. "There's going to be peace in my time. In other words, his vision, the good man that he was, he only had a vision for his own time. I'm going to have peace in my time. And as long as I can live out the rest of my little 15 years in peace, that's fine by me. And his vision was so limited, it was so selfish in many ways. As long as I have peace, what happens in the future is no real concern of mine. That seems to be the issue. As long as I have peace, and me and mine are happy and well supplied, and have peace with God, then that's the limit of our concern. And the tragedy is that sometimes we forget that we are part of a bigger picture. God has an overarching, vast purpose of grace. And we are only playing a small part in it. And it's difficult for us to see meaning in the things that come to us in life. One of the characteristics of the times in which we live, actually, and in which the church, I think, is sharing in this kind of pessimism, is that we are living in a pessimistic age. And the farther that God is removed from our thinking, the more pessimistic we are going to be. Because if there is no purpose ultimately in your life and in mine that comes from God's hand upon us and his purpose of grace and mercy toward us, then any meaning in our life must be self-made. We must inject some meaning or purpose into our life. And there is nobody lives his life without a purpose. Everybody in life, whether we're living in the gutter or whether we're living in the highest echelons of society and prosperity, we all have a purpose. We all have plans. There are some people go out on a Friday and a Saturday night and they say, my plan tonight is to go and get drunk. And that's what they intend to do. Maybe they will get drunk, maybe they will not. There are others and they say that before the age of 40, I'm going to become a millionaire. That may well be realized. But they're living for a purpose. We study for a purpose. We get married for a purpose. We go to join a sports club or a sailing club or something in order for a purpose. We all have meanings in our life that we put into our life. And yet at the same time, those who would say that we as people, we must have meaning in our lives, seem at the same time to be reluctant to allow that God also has purpose and meaning in what he does in our little world. We don't like the idea that maybe God has a purpose and that his purposes are going to stand while ours are going to be failing so often. You and I, as we look back on our lives as we get older, every single one of us looks back with disappointment, because the fact of the matter is things do not work out as we had initially hoped. In the exuberance of youth, and even our Christian lives do not work out the way that we have planned when we're converted, that we are going to set the world on fire. We are going to be the ones to live as the bright lights for Christ in our generation. And we find, looking back, that we've been pretty ordinary and we've been largely failures and we've had many falls along the road. And man proposes, but God disposes. Even the world has that saying. But that is good biblical orthodoxy in a sense. And we're living in a world of pessimism because God is not in our thinking. We could think of some of the great influences. Take, for example, Bertrand Russell, the great English philosopher and mathematician, an absolute avowed atheist. And he was depressed by the fact that there seemed to be no meaning in life. He said on one occasion, all civilization, all the attainments of men, all that wisdom that the ages have accumulated, all the cities, everything that man has achieved, he says, it's almost unbelievable. He said that it's all going to end in destruction and darkness. He says, I can hardly believe it's without meaning. But he says, I don't see any meaning. It's going to end in darkness. And he says, I can hardly bear the thought that it's all going to end in destruction and in darkness and mean ultimately nothing. And you have other men speaking in the same way. Steven Weinberg, that great physicist, Nobel Prize winner in physics, wrote a very famous book called The First 3 Minutes, one of the classics of popular science, we might say. And at the end of that book, he said, one of the amazing things, he said, is that more the world is comprehensible, and the more we understand it, the more pointless it seems to be. And you have this over and over again. H.A.L. Lindsay, you remember, the great British historian who wrote that great history of Europe. He says in the preface to that book, to volume one, he says, there is something that has been denied to me, he says. And that is the excitement of seeing a purpose and a pattern in history. He says, other men wiser than I have seen a pattern, and they have seen a meaningful purpose. He says, I do not see it. All I see is one crisis after another, one event, one wave after another, one event which doesn't seem to be related to any other and seems to be going nowhere. And you have these men who are recognized as the intellectual giants of our world, and there are many others like them. A.N. Whitehead, he speaks of God as being just an idea that comes out of our developing intellectual activity. And we could give example after example. Now you might say, well, why are you telling us all this? I'm telling you that because that's the kind of thinking that's influencing our world today. That's the kind of thinking that's influencing our children in the kindergarten. There is no God. There is no meaning, ultimately, of a higher moral order. There is nothing to be sought, nothing to be gained, other than that which is controlled by the laws of physics and chemistry. And in the Bible, we read that there is something which is quite different, where men are saying there is no meaning, ultimately, except what we inject into our little existence. And God is saying, I have a purpose too. And my purpose is going to stand because he does not do things, as it were, willy-nilly, haphazard. He works according to a pattern, and he works according to a program. And that is what these verses this morning are telling us. Remember the former things of old. Why did these former things ever happen at all? Because I brought them to pass, he is saying. And at the end of this passage, verses 9 to 11, I have spoken it. I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, and I also will do it. Now, what is this chapter as a whole teaching us? Why does God speak in this way in this particular chapter? Well, let's look at the chapter. Let's look at the opening verses. In the opening two verses, we're told of the vanity of idols. Bel boweth down. That was one of the Babylonian gods. Nebo, another of the Babylonian gods. They stoop down. They bow low. They come to an end. He reminds the Babylonians, their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle. It means that when these gods moved from place to place, they had to be carried on the backs of beasts of burden. They couldn't move or they couldn't do anything except beasts, cattle, and beasts of burden would carry them. Your carriages were heavy laden with these burdens of idols. The burden for the weary beast. The beasts were getting tired, so to speak, of carrying these idols from place to place. They stoop, they bow down together. They could not deliver the burden. They couldn't ease the burden of the animal. They couldn't ease the burden of the people. They themselves are gone into captivity. Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, he says. And then at verse number 6, he again returns to this theme of the foolishness of idolatry. We've already seen it in chapter 44. The religions that men invent for themselves, they can't save, they can't deliver. There's no point, as we saw in a previous sermon recently. There's no point. What's the point in having a religion that doesn't save? What's the point in saying prayers if there's no God to hear these prayers? What's the point of having a religion that simply sees the end of it all in going through the ritualism of prayer or offering of sacrifices or whatever it is? The utter vanity of these idols. And what God is saying to us, what he is saying as part of his purpose is, I'm going to destroy false religions. I'm going to bring down not only the idols of Babylon, but the idols of every Babylon that will ever arise. We're going to see next time the fall of Babylon itself in the next chapter. And here we are being reminded that the Lord's purpose is, I am against them who make these false idols. And then he reminds the people of Israel from verse number 3. On the one hand, he's against the false gods and the false religions. But on the other hand, he is for his people Israel. Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly. The gods of the heathen are carried by the people and the beasts of burden of the people. But the people of God are not carried on beasts, they're carried on the backs of God. They're carried in God's hands. It is God who carries his people. They don't carry him from place to place. He carries them from place to place. That's the picture, you see, which are born by me from the belly, from the very beginning and all through their existence until the end of their existence in this world. It is God who carries them and he bears them up. They are carried from the womb. Even I, even to your old age, I am he. As long as you live, even until you get gray in the hair, he says, I will still carry you. He says in verse number 4, I have made and I will bear and I will carry and I will deliver you. To whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we may be like? In other words, he's asking his people to remember that he is a God who knows what he's doing and he knows why he's doing it. He preserves his people because he has a purpose for them. And the end of his purpose is one of glory and mercy and peace and not destruction. And then at the end of the chapter, verses 12 and 13, there is an appeal that is made to sinners to listen and to come into this great salvation. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted. That is those who are strong against God, that are far from righteousness. Those who are not even seeking after the God of Israel and the God of salvation. He says, listen to me. Because the idols won't hear you, but I will hear you. When at the end of chapter 45 he says, look unto me and be ye saved and call upon me. Then he is reminding people that when they look, they will find him, they will see him. Everyone who seeks him will find him. And everybody who calls upon him is going to be listened to by him. And those who ask for his mercy, they will find that he will give them mercy. And that's what these closing verses are all about. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted that are far from righteousness. I will bring near my righteousness. It shall not be far off. You come near to me, and I will come near to you. And my salvation will not tarry. You won't have to wait long when you call upon me and draw near to me. You will be finding salvation immediately. It's not something that I will say, well, I'll bless you in 25 years' time. I will bless you now, today. And those who call upon him today are blessed today with his salvation. Is this not what Jesus was teaching in that passage concerning the publican who went up to the temple to pray? He went up and he didn't have a long prayer. He wasn't a man who felt good about himself. He felt very bad. He had nothing to commend himself before God. All he could do was to stand away from the holy, righteous Pharisee and bow low and not even lift up his eyes to heaven, beating upon his breast. And all he could say was, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. And as far as we know, that was about it. He didn't know what else to say. And Jesus said that man, when he went away from that place, was justified. He didn't have to go and do something in addition. He simply asked for mercy and he found it. And this is the theme of the Bible from beginning to end. Now, why am I emphasizing this broad, apparently desultory introduction to the sermon? Because we're still in the introduction, you see. I'm speaking about it in these broad terms because God is purposeful. God knows what he's doing even when we have no idea what he's doing or why. He knows. And that means that the decline and the disintegration of so much of Christianity with which we are familiar today, this is no accident. It's not that things are out of his control. He has appointed it. He has determined it. And He has determined it not for our destruction, but for our good, and ultimately for the destruction of the idols and the false religions with which our world has always abounded. You see, God allows evil to have its day. He allows it to have its head. He allows Babylon to have its time. He allows Assyria to have its time. And they would boast of their achievements. He allows Persia to have its time. And the Greeks and the Romans and every empire ever since. He gives them time. And then He cuts them off. Because He knows that they are those with whom He is going to deal graciously with His people, even in hard times. So what then can we say as we look then particularly at these verses in God is purposeful? There are a number of things we can say. The first thing evidently is the absolute sovereignty of God in His dealings, both with His people and with those who are not His people. We need to keep this in mind today. Because it is rather interesting, you know, that when the Christian church loses confidence in the sovereignty of God, there is something very noticeable takes place in the Christian community and in Christian pulpits. And that is, there is no emphasis on the sovereignty of God. There is hardly a word spoken about the sovereignty of God. And so the message spoken from pulpits and the message entertained in the pews is one of a God whom, indeed, for whom we have to do great things, rather than simply relying upon Him doing great things for us. Now, the sovereignty of God is not some lazy cushion whereby we can lay down our lazy heads, say, let God and let go. Not at all. The sovereignty of God is the ultimate impetus for us to be up and doing. We're to be like Him. But nonetheless, we need to be reminded that the works that we do are inspired by His sovereignty. We are to work out what God works in. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. We work at it. Why do we work at it? Because it is God who is working within you, both to will and to do of His own purpose. And so here in verse number 5 particularly, we are being reminded that there is nothing comparable to God in the way that He works. He does it freely according to His own choice in the matter. And He will bring it to pass. We're to remember that. And I have purposed it, He says in verse 11. And I will bring it to pass. In our recent studies in Romans 9, 10 and 11, you remember, when we're looking at the sovereignty of God emphasized in Romans chapter 9, we tried to make the point on a number of occasions. Romans chapter 9 is not the great chapter on the ultimate sovereignty of God. It is the sovereignty of God in salvation. The chapter that really deals with the sovereignty of God is the chapter in the Bible that deals with creation. Because God is establishing once and for all His imprimatur of rights. Everything belongs to Him and He can do with it as He pleases. And that is the sovereignty of God. He determines how long creation is going to take, in what order things are going to work out, and whether there's going to be a creation or whether not, and whether man is going to be simply a beast upon the earth or a peculiar a creature made in God's likeness. He will determine that. And this is what we're being reminded of here. He is saying, I have a purpose. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, they've got their own agenda. Cyrus had his own purpose in setting the Jews free. He set everybody free, it seems, and sent back their gods where they belonged. And he had his own agenda. And as far as Israel was concerned, God raised him up for Israel's good. And so there is the sovereignty of God. But there's another thing that we're reminded of here, and it is the mystery of providence. I mentioned this last time, the great Puritan Flavel wrote a great treatise on this, the mystery of providence. And by the mystery of providence, he meant simply not that we can't understand anything about the way that God works. Of course we can understand a great deal about the way that God works, because He tells us how He works. And when we come to the Bible, we know a great deal about God. We know the way that He is long-suffering and patient. We know from the many biographical accounts that we have in the Old Testament of people's lives. We know the way He deals with people. So we do know how God deals with people in the world. And we know how He deals with saints, and we know how He deals with sinners. Because He not only tells us in words, but He works it out in lives. And we know how sin can destroy lives, because we have examples of it in the Bible. And so there is the mystery of providence, not in the sense that we don't know anything about it, but that we don't know everything about it. And we don't know the bigger picture. We know the limits of our own experiences of these things. And that is the danger always for you and for me, to start laying down general principles and saying, this is the answer to this question, because this is what I found out. Well, it may be partially the answer. It may be on the right lines. But the mystery of providence remains in God's hands. And even when we read through the Bible, we still are only on the outskirts of His garments, on the fringes of His ways. There are things about God. The Jewish scholars used to say that there were 7,000 attributes of God. Others used to say that there was an infinite number of attributes. I have no idea. But it may well be the case that there are attributes of God that we know nothing about. He tells us about Himself insofar as it is important for us to know certain things for our salvation. The Bible is not given to us to tell us everything about God. It's a book that tells us how we can be right with God and how God has made things right between us and Himself through Jesus Christ. That's what the Bible's all about, to make us wise unto salvation. The Bible is limited in its intention. And that means that our understanding of God's providence always is going to be a mystery in the end. And we will only know it insofar as He tells us about it. But you and I have questions. Why does God seem to take so long? Why does He seem to be so long in accomplishing His purposes? Why did it take 400 and more years for the people of Israel in Egypt before God finally came and visited them and took them out? We would say, why didn't He do that? As soon as they began to suffer, why did He not come and immediately deliver His people? Why? Because the time wasn't right, that's why. 400 years almost of suffering. From the times of Joseph, it seems that the people of Israel, as they multiplied in Egypt, became increasingly those whom the Egyptians regarded with hostility, increasingly enslaved. You don't enslave nations overnight in that way without a warfare. There's no indication that the Egyptians ever made war before the Exodus time, that they ever made war on the people of Israel and enslaved them. There's no record of it if they did. It was a gradual development of superiority by the Egyptians over the people of Israel. It took a long time. Why did God allow it? I don't know why He allowed it, because it seems good in His sight. Why does He put up with the world mocking and criticizing and dominating and persecuting His church down through the ages? You see, the history of Christianity is not only a tragic history of internal dissension and disagreement. It is largely a history of oppression by the world. Wherever Christianity has risen up in its true purity, it has always been opposed. Why does God allow this? 20 centuries have passed now in the Christian age, centuries in the Old Testament history. And we might say, why does God take so long to come and deliver His people? And I'm sure that's a question that you have asked out of a cry from your heart. It's a question that I often ask. Why does He not seem to answer our prayers? Because I've got no doubt whatsoever that when you and I pray for the revival of the church, we mean revival now. And we mean revival in our circle and in our circumstances. I don't doubt that. But it's not happening. There are people for whom I have been praying for many, many years now, and you also, and they're still not saved. And they may never be saved for all we know. Why are there so few saved? Why is it? Jesus said, there are few that find the way into the kingdom. Why? Why doesn't God make the door of salvation so broad that all poor sinners, helpless in their sin, who can't lift a hand to help themselves, why doesn't he open the door of salvation like a floodgate to the multitudes? Because after all, you and I are no better than the multitudes out there. And the answer is, we don't know why there are so few that find it. Why did he choose the people of Israel? Well, he assures them, or disabuses them rather, of any idea that it might be their grandeur. I didn't choose you, he said, because you were mighty, because you were more inclined to believe in one God than any other nation. You were no different. You were heathens. Abraham was brought up as an idolater. He worshipped idols beyond the river, we're told. He was a heathen. And God in some way made himself known to him and chose him out to make of him the great nation that would be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. Why, Israel? Why you? Why me? Why not the man next door to us in the train as we're traveling? Why does God do the things? We don't know why he does it, because he never tells us why. He simply says, I choose my people because I love my people, not because of anything great in them. And so here the people of Israel, you see, they are being reminded again that when they think that they are being hard done by the Lord is reminding them that they are not being judged and being dealt with as their sins deserve. They could be cast off like the Babylonians could be. They could be cast off like the Assyrians. He's going to raise up other empires in the future, and they're going to be cast off. And God can do that to Israel, but he says, I'm not going to do it to Israel. And who makes them to differ? Who makes you and me this morning to differ? Well, we know who it is that makes the difference, but we don't know why. And there's no point whatsoever in some Christian people saying there's something that we did or some germ of godliness within us. We, like others, are dead in trespasses and in sins, and we were children of wrath. It's hard for me to consider, as a Christian man now, I believe, that I was once a child of wrath and not a child of grace. It's hard for us as Christians to imagine that before we were converted, we were just like everybody else, and God was as angry with us as he was with anybody out there. That's why Paul says, wherefore remember. You see, we do not believe in the doctrine of justification from eternity. We believe in predestination from eternity and foreknowledge. But we do not believe that we are justified from eternity. We are justified the moment we believe and not before we believe in Christ. We are justified at the moment of our new birth, when we enter into a different scheme of things and a different sphere of reality. So there is the mystery of providence. And then there is history. And I must press on, because time is pressing on. And this book of Isaiah, in these closing chapters, is dealing with history. Bel boweth down. Is this some religious idea? No. Bel bowed down. Bel was brought down. If you look up a Bible dictionary or something like that, you'll find Babylon. And there's quite large articles about Babylon. And you can read the whole history of Babylon. And you can read how Babylon began and how it rose up and how it had its moment of victories and prosperity. This great Babylon that I have built, you remember, in Daniel chapter 4, verse 30. Nebuchadnezzar, proud over this great city of Babylon. And it was almost inconceivable to the Babylonians in that day that not very long afterwards, Bel, their god, and Nebo, their god, they would bow down and they would be no more. And so these things are historical. And the same with the people of God being carried from the womb and even unto their gray hairs. This is not some sweet doctrine, some nice idea to buttress our vain hopes and make us cheerful in difficult times. This is historical reality. God did bear them up, and he's bearing them up still. And when Jesus Christ says, I will build my church and the gates of hell or Hades will not prevail against my church. That's not just some kind of foolish, aggrandized promise which can never be fulfilled. He's simply stating reality in history. My church will be built. He doesn't say that any particular congregation will be built, or that any particular denomination will never have the gates of Hades prevailing against it. But he says, my church will never die, because I will do the building. In other words, it's all history, you see. So when we're speaking about God's purpose, we're speaking about God's purpose in history. And that raises the obvious question, who is in control of history? Is there control in history? Is there any meaning? Is H.A.L. Fisher right in his pessimistic view when he says, I see no purpose, no plan? Is there no plan? Just because he can't see a plan. Of course, if you exclude God and if you don't take the teaching of the Bible seriously, then of course there's going to be no plan. And Steven Weinberg is quite right. If in fact there is no God and there is no purposeful God who plans things in advance, then he's quite right. The more the world is analyzed and becomes comprehensible, the less meaningful it seems to be. And he goes on to say, it's very difficult for us. Steven Weinberg, again, I'm quoting him. It's very difficult for us to imagine that this world, which began in such strange circumstances, is going to end up in eternal cold or eternal heat. He wasn't sure which. Gamow says it's going to be both. We're going to be burnt up and frozen up at the same time, he said. But you see, the point is, take God out of it. And of course there is meaninglessness, except what we inject as best we can. So history, does it have a purpose? The Bible, according to its own teaching, is the clue to understanding history. And the purpose of history focuses really on one central theme, and that is God has a people in the world. They are the apple of his eye. He gives nations for them. Christ rules all things for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. It's a staggering thought. It's almost, we might say, a statement of supreme madness to maintain that we, the Christian community, this little group of strange people who believe the strangest things, that we can be the centerpiece of the purpose for the purpose of this world. Is that madness? Is it true? Or is it the most dangerous deception that has ever befallen a group of people to believe such things? And these closing chapters in Isaiah are meant to encourage God's people who were the chosen apples of his eye, his anointed ones, that this is how he views them. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians may view them just as another defeated nation, but God sees them as a redeemed community, the representatives of a heavenly kingdom which will never, ever go out in defeat. That's you and me this morning if we are Christians according to the Bible. God is purposeful. And the moment that we lose sight of the sovereignty of God, we forget that the things that we must do for God pale into total comparison, with the great things that God is doing for us. And the final comment this morning is not only the great mystery of providence, the reality of God's sovereignty, the purposefulness of history, but also this idea of prophecy. I have spoken it, the Lord says at the end of verse 11. I have spoken it. I have already told you what I've done in the past. I'm telling you what I'm doing in the future. I'm still carrying you even till your gray hairs and even to the grave. I'm still going to carry you on. but I'm also telling you of things that I'm going to do in the future. And Isaiah is speaking of things that were going to take place 200 years, less and then more, from his own times. And this raises the issue, doesn't it, of prophecy. You see, we find today that there is an increasingly strange, and I would put to you a totally unbiblical view of prophecy that we find in the Bible. We're being told today, and if in fact you believe in this, what I regard as a false view, then you tell me, please, why you think it's the true view. There are those increasingly in the church and always in the world saying that those prophecies of the Bible, such as the raising up of Cyrus, for example, that we're considering last Sunday morning, and we saw how the scholars say this could not have been written 200 years before Cyrus. These things don't happen. You don't name individuals in that way centuries before they are brought into history. And so therefore Isaiah chapter 45 must have been written after the event of Cyrus. That's the modern view. That's the natural view. And that's the view that increasingly is infecting the church even today. And we're being told today that the real meaning of prophecy in the Bible is not history written beforehand, but simply a word for the times of God's people, so that prophesying is limited simply to preaching issues. And Isaiah is speaking to comfort his people in the circumstances of their day. And he's not referring to events in the future. He's promising vague things, but he's not sure really. Because he can't be sure, you see. Nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. But when we come to the Bible, we find that prophecy is in fact recorded as history written before it comes to pass. And so when the Lord is saying here, I have spoken it, I will bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I will do it, he is not telling us what Cyrus is going to do so much as he is telling us what he is going to do in Cyrus. He's not telling us so much about what the Babylonians are going to do to Judah. He's telling us of what he is going to do with Judah through the Babylonians. In other words, he is going to raise up that hasty and bitter people, the Chaldeans. And so prophecy in the Bible is not simply what are men going to do. It is what is God going to do. Prophecy is God telling us what he intends to do for his people. And when we look at the prophecies of the Bible, and there are many of the prophecies of the Bible, many prophecies, what we are in fact reading is God's promises, I will do this for you. And at the end of the day, I will make the rough places smooth for you because you can't. And I will make the crooked places straight because you can't. You can't sort out the world. You can't deal with people like Cyrus and the Babylonians and the Antichrist and the beasts and the false prophet and the great scarlet-coated woman sitting on the beast that we're going to look at in Revelation chapter 17. You can't deal with these people, but I can. Every time they make war against God's people, they always win. They make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them because he is the King of Kings and the Lord. He overcomes them. And he overcomes them for us. And so when we're thinking of God having a purpose, we are thinking of God having a purpose for his own glory, but for the good of his people. When an artist or anybody else sets out to do something, whether going onto a tennis court, you intend to do something, it might work out well, it might work out badly, but at least you have a purpose and you set to with a will to do it. But when God sets to do it, there's no uncertainties in the matter. I will bring it all to pass. And so what does the future hold for you and for me? What did it hold for Israel? It held blessing. The cup of wrath was a cup of blessing, preservation. You and I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or next year. But we do know the big picture, you see. And the big picture is bright. The big picture includes all the little eddies and the times when the tide is out. And God's blessing seems to be far distant, and we don't seem to be enjoying the good things of the Lord. And so we're scratching around trying to make good times for the Lord. And God is saying to us, I'll bring it to pass. And I know what I'm doing. I think I've quoted to you before Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, that great man. He said one of the things that characterizes the Christian church, he was talking of the last century, is he saw himself, and I remember him saying it. I heard the man preaching in the flesh. And I'll tell you what, he was a very good preacher. But anyway, he said on one occasion, he said one of the things that he was noticing as he was going through life and the experience of wisdom was an increasing pessimism among the people of God. They seemed to have lost the vision of God. They had lost direction. They had lost the view of the sovereignty of God. And those of you who know something of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones will know that in the latter years of his ministry, he only really had one sermon. He had many texts, he had many sermons, but it was the same drum that he was beating. It was the littleness of man and the greatness of God. And if you look at his latter sermons, you find that that's what he was preaching about. Man in his pride. Little man, he used to say. And the great God. That's exactly what Isaiah's preaching about. And that's the vision that we need to recapture. Because your future and mine as Christians, tomorrow it might be dark for all we know. But in the far future it is full of brightness, the brightness of glory. Because if we are Christians, we are going to go to heaven. We are going to heaven. And we're going to be guided and we're going to be protected every step of the way. I will carry you to your old age. I will continue to carry you. And if God does not fulfill his promises, then I tell you this, in the wisdom of a good old Scottish dying lady, Mary. She says, if Christ does not fulfill his promises to me, then he loses more than I lose. I lose my soul. But he loses his integrity. She got it right, you see. She was right. That's why the Lord says concerning his promises, by myself I have sworn it. If I do not bring it to pass for my people, then I will cease to be the God that I am and I claim to be. And that's what this is all about. The purposes of God. Remember the past. Look to the future. And in the present, in all the mystery of providence that we simply can't understand, doesn't matter. He understands it. And through Jesus Christ, he has brought to pass something that we do understand. And that is the immeasurable grandeur of his love. And my people will never perish because Christ gives to us eternal life. Now that's just a kind of broad picture of the big picture, if you know what I mean. But that's the kind of thing that Isaiah is talking about in all of these chapters. God is always there. He is always the same. He is always angry with his enemies. He is always merciful and gracious to everybody who believes in him. Amen.